WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the field of crime fiction, one of the most versatile and successful writers is my guest, Donald Westlake. He's the author of a series of comic caper novels about an inept thief named John Dortmunder. His novels, The Hot Rock and The Bank Shot, were adapted into films. Westlake has written darker crime series under the pen names Richard Stark and Tucker Coe. Westlake wrote the screenplays for The Stepfather and The Grifters and is currently doing a screenplay for Martin Scorsese. Westlake's new book, The Axe, is a crime novel that captures the desperation and anger of the newly unemployed. The Axe is about a middle-class family man, a product manager in a paper mill, who has been downsized out of his job. He sends out resumes, but nothing happens. As he slips out of the middle class, he devises a plan to get back his income, health insurance, and security. The plan requires killing off his competition. Here's a reading from the opening of The Axe.
I've never actually killed anybody before, murdered another person, snuffed out another human being. In a way, oddly enough, I wish I could talk to my father about this, since he did have the experience, had what we in the corporate world call the background in that area of expertise, he having been an infantryman in the Second World War, having seen action in the final march across France into Germany in 44-45, having shot at and certainly wounded and more than likely killed any number of men in dark gray wool, and having been quite calm about it all in retrospect. How do you know beforehand that you can do it? That's the question. Well, of course, I couldn't ask my father that, discuss it with him, not even if he were still alive, which he isn't, the cigarettes and the lung cancer having caught up with him in his 63rd year, putting him down as surely, if not as efficiently, as if he had been a distant enemy in dark gray wool. The question, in any case, will answer itself, won't it? I mean, this is the sticking point. Either I can do it or I can't. If I can't, then all the preparation, all the planning, the files I've maintained, the expense I've put myself to when God knows I can't afford it, have been in vain, and I might as well throw it all away, run no more ads, do no more scheming, simply allow myself to fall back into the herd of steer mindlessly lurching toward the big dark barn where the mooing stops. This has to work. I have to get out of this morass, and soon, which means I'd better be capable of murder.
Donald Westlake, let me ask you to describe this character's plan for getting a good supervisory job back at a paper mill.
Well, it sort of grows gradually with him. He begins by realizing that every time he applies for a job, a lot of other people in the same, roughly in the same business apply for the same job. And he's sending out resumes, and they're sending out resumes, and one of them gets picked. And it begins with a kind of desperate curiosity. What are they saying? How are they presenting themselves that they get picked and I don't? And he figures out a way to attract resumes. He puts a fake ad in a journal of his area of expertise and gets the resumes just to see what they're like, and realizes that there is always going to be somebody out there a little better than him. And that leads him on to the next step of, do I give in to despair or do I choose rage instead? And he says, well, I've got all these resumes, now what? And from there, it is somehow both a very large step and a very small step to say, let me pick out the guys who are better than me and get rid of them.
Kill them.
Kill them.
Now, I like that this is a crime novel, not from the point of view of a professional criminal. This is a murder novel from the point of view of a very middle-class, middle-management guy who's been downsized out of his job. He's always played it by the rules until this point, because now he feels incredibly cheated because the rules have been changed on him. And this isn't supposed to happen to the middle class.
Exactly. Yeah, the middle class is supposed to have given up all claim on the highs in return for not being subjected to any of the lows. And all of a sudden, that's not working.
How did you decide to write a crime novel about downsizing?
I don't know. I think it was in the air. I've known several people in different parts of it. I know a couple of people who were downsized over the last few years. I know a woman who's just retired from a very large corporation. She was an executive, and she spent much of the last 4 years firing people. You know, there's always the farewell interview with the sympathetic executive. You know, they don't go away mad, just go away. And she was the sympathetic executive, and she hated it. She was, I would see her on weekends, and she would just be distraught. But she knew that she wasn't going to get fired, and that she had her own retirement out there in front of her, and that she would survive somehow. But seeing it from that side, I have another friend who was an expert in financial planning with a big company, and they were downsizing all around her. She was too good to fire, and they kept adding things onto her. So she was a victim of it in another way. She was having nightmares, and all of her friends were saying, get out of that job. And she was afraid to, and then they offered her a raise of $5 a week.
Wow.
And she quit.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They're just naturally mean, I think. I don't know what it is.
Well, your character is so kind of upset by all the euphemisms that he's been dealt. Did your friends pass on some of these to you?
Well, some I got from that. And then I was about 3 weeks into the actual writing of the book, and I've been planning it a little bit, and then actually sitting down and writing it. And I think it was 3 weeks in, and the New York Times did a week-long front page study of the area of downsizing. And I said, oh my God, the Times has done my research for me. And it's very much what I had already started to do, they described. But I got a lot of the euphemisms and the terminologies from them. And my favorite of them was one that AT&T used, because it was supposed to be a euphemism, but it's actually more horrible than saying you're fired. And that was, your job is not moving forward. Well, out of your peripheral vision to both sides, you can see jobs that are moving forward. I mean, this is death being described to you.
This character finds that retraining is not going to be very helpful to him, but he's actually retraining himself to be a killer.
Yes, he talks about the learning curve of being a murderer.
What do you think it takes for an ordinary man to become a killer?
Oh, well, I think if it is going to be possible, and it is possible in some people and less possible in others, desperation is the first thing, and then combined maybe with responsibility and guilt. I think if a guy says, what am I going to do for myself? He is less likely to go that far than if he says, what am I going to do for myself and my wife and my children who are looking at me trustingly? I'm supposed to be steering this ship, and I seem to have lost the rudder. And that, I think, is what drives people to go beyond themselves, much less the idea of going beyond the law. That drives them beyond what they would normally do in any circumstance.
You know, I like your novel, The Axe, both as a crime novel about, you know, the ordinary person turned murderer, but also, I think it's like very perceptive about the kinds of things that go wrong in a family when somebody's out of work, and very perceptive about the middle class today. And I'm wondering why you chose a crime form to write, you know, what's in part a kind of social commentary.
Well, because the social I won't deny the social commentary. That's not, you know, I don't want to be coy about this, but the fact is that I think of myself as a storyteller. That what I do is I write novels, I write fiction, and the novelist's first responsibility is to tell a story, and a story is always about one person, and you have to have that person in motion for a reason before you can have a story, and I don't see how I could just have him sit and feel sorry for himself and have something that you would like to read as a story.
Why did you turn to crime as a writer? Was that just a kind of handy genre in which it was easy to get established and easy to make money early on, or was there some deeper interest in you that led to crime?
No, it was simpler than that, really. I started quite young, and I wrote everything. I wrote slices of life and sent them off to the Swanee Review, and I did try my hand at science fiction, although I knew nothing about it. I grew up in upstate New York. I was never farther west than Syracuse, and I tried to write westerns. I did anything. And the mystery stories started to get published, and I think there's a natural tendency to go where you're liked. And so the more they were published, the more I wrote them. And I spent 10 years saying, well, I'm a writer disguised as a mystery writer. And then I looked back at this pile of manuscripts behind me and said, well, maybe I'm a mystery writer.
Well, maybe you're both. I mean...
I think so. I think I'm both. By now, I'm both, yes.
My guest is Donald Westlake. His new novel is called The Axe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with crime writer Donald Westlake. You broke into writing by writing true confession stories, I think.
You know too much.
How did you get started with it?
Well, I came to New York. I wanted to write, and I was starting to write. And I came to New York and got a job with a literary agency, one of the ones where amateurs send in their short stories with money and the agent, or an ink-stained wretch working for the agent like me, tells that person, your story is no good, but send us another story with some more money because you sure have a lot of talent. And I worked for him, and he would get assignments from little publishers, paperbacks, book publishers, or magazine publishers. And you never knew what kind of a job offer would show up, you know, go write a story about this or that. And so when I first got there, his assistant, or another guy there, said, if that guy ever says to you, do you know anything about, say yes, whatever it is, and you'll get an assignment. So he said, do you know anything about confession stories? And I said, oddly enough, yes. A friend of mine and I did a content analysis on confession stories in college. And so I went on from there, and I pulled out that old content analysis and just did every recurring short story, and they loved them.
What were some of the things that you got from your own content analysis?
The probably the most popular one was the woman who goes to bed with her husband's boss in order to get him the raise and then discovers he would have gotten it anyway. That was big. That's about the only one I can remember now. That's been a long time ago.
So did you write one of those?
Oh, sure. I think that's the first one I did.
First person, of course, because it's meant to be a confession.
Oh, those were all, yes. Somebody described the formula for those things as sin, suffer, repent.
No, was this a useful exercise for you as a writer?
Yeah, I think so, in a funny way. I mean, after a while, you know, it's like candy. Some of it is good and too much of it is bad. It was a learning experience in a couple of ways, in speaking in that female voice all the time, and in getting in and out of the story quick. You know, you've got 3,000 words to paint a life, really, with this serious or perhaps serial comic event in the middle of it, and then come out on the other side. So that was it was like good etudes, you know. It was good practice.
You've written a lot of books over the years under pen names, including Tucker Coe and Richard Stark. Did you have commercial reasons for using pen names?
At the beginning, yes. I was writing an awful lot, and publishers are afraid of that. They say readers don't want to keep hearing from you too often. And I also was writing different kinds of things. It turned out that I didn't like to keep doing the same thing over and over. So partly it was brand name. You know, if you want something lighter, except by now that doesn't hold anymore because the Axe isn't lighter. But in those days, if you want something lighter, then here I am as Westlake. And if you want something colder, then here I am as Stark. And if you like a good emotional private eye type thing, then here's this fellow Co. Those lasted for a while, and then Co sort of dried up after five books, and Stark went away for 24 years and is returning. All of a sudden, I could not be more surprised myself, but Richard Stark has another book coming out in September.
How has the market for crime books changed since you started writing them?
Drastically. Mostly for the better. I think it may have peaked. I hope not, but it may have. We may have started down the other slope. But when I was first starting, my first book was published by Random House in 1960. And at that time, except for Simon & Schuster, in every hardcover publishing house in New York City that published mysteries, the mystery editor was also the cookbook editor. They were just two little, unimportant, money-making things off in the corner that nobody cared about. And it's been a long time. There are always writers in there who said, I don't care what you think. I want to have some fun and write this. But gradually it changed, and it changed over a course of 15 or 20 years. And for the last maybe 15 years, it's been terrific. There's been a lot of attention paid to the field. The cookbook editor is somebody else now, and there are entire stores devoted. I mean, the idea in 1960 that there would be four or five stores in New York City alone devoted exclusively to mysteries would have been absurd.
You've written in the first-person voice of both, burglars and private eyes, the cop and the criminal.
Yes.
Do you get into a mental state depending on whether you're writing from the criminal's point of view or the investigator's point of view?
Oh yeah. Well, I always go along with my characters. I say, oh yeah, I see what you mean. Even in the acts, I say, oh yeah, right, I see what you mean, because I couldn't have written the acts unless I had found his voice and his conviction in his own properness. While the book is underway, while I am telling myself the story, I have to buy into what he thinks, or there's no way for me to do it. I know. Evan Hunter is an old friend of mine, and he always maintains is that everybody has a motive. People don't just behave in irrational ways. It can look irrational from outside. But if you're going to write a story, the first thing you have to do is figure out what that person's motive is. Why would he do that? And so that's why Evan hates things like locked room murders. You know, there's no reason to do that. Not if you have a gun.
And this is Evan Hunter, a.k.a. Ed McBain.
Ed McBain, yeah.
You've been doing some screenplays in addition to novels. You wrote the screenplay for The Grifters, adapted from
yes.
a Jim Thompson story.
Yes.
Wrote the screenplay for The Stepfather. And two really good movies, I think. Very different. Both really good screenplays. And now I believe you're doing a rewrite of the film A Double Life. And this is a film that Martin Scorsese had brought out on video as part of the Martin Scorsese Presents series a while back.
Uh-huh. I hadn't realized he'd done that.
He's
the producer on this. Actually, I'm doing two things with him. But until he and the Dalai Lama are finished with each other, nobody's
right.
doing anything with him. And they're both remakes. We're in an era of remakes, I'm afraid. But one is A Double Life, in which Ronald Colman won an Academy Award for his performance as an actor who goes mad while playing Othello and very nearly kills his wife, who's playing Desdemona, and does kill a waitress played by Shelley Winters. Very interesting. It was written by Ruth Gordon and Garson Kanin, and the original one was directed by George Cukor. And it's very, very interesting story of this guy's helplessness before what's happening to him. It's got a nice downward projection to it. And then the other one, we go back to Ed McBain all of a sudden, is the wonderful Kurosawa movie High and Low, which was based on an Ed McBain novel called King's Ransom. The idea of that story is a well-to-do businessman at a very tense moment when he's got all of his money committed to trying to take over the business, and kidnappers kidnap his 9-year-old son, except they get the wrong kid. They get the chauffeur's kid. And then they say, that's all right, we want the money anyway. And he would put himself at risk for his own child, but will he put himself at risk for the chauffeur's child? And that's a wonderful moral question. So that, and I sort of have dealer's choice on this because Evan, in his book, in his Ed McBain book, King's Ransom, he answered the question one way, and Kurosawa in the movie answered it the other way.
Well, Donald Westlake, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Donald Westlake's new novel is called The Axe. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.